Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Hi everyone, it's Jesse Green here. Welcome back to SavvyDentist.com and to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. My guest today is someone who's been around podcasting for a long time. In fact, his show has over 250 episodes and his YouTube channel is growing daily, weekly. It's a thing that's got a life of its own. My guest, of course, is Eric Hunley, and Eric is the host of the Unstructured Podcast, and he's got his own YouTube channel where he interviews all sorts of interesting people, whether they be spies, whether they be clandestine operatives, so on and so forth. And in our conversation today, we're talking a lot about communication. We're talking a lot about how the art of listening is really, really nuanced and really subtle. And Eric shares some wonderful skills and practical tools to enhance your communication skills through effective listening. He's also got some wonderful tips to share around things he's learned from other high-profile guests on his show, guests such as Chris Voss, the FBI negotiator, and guests such as David Fries, who is also from the clandestine operatives world and who was also a guest at our event, Practice Mastery. So it's a really interesting podcast, and it's a slow conversation with lots of gold, and it's a gentle conversation where we talk about a variety of different things, and we do go down quite a few different paths, and I'd encourage you to really listen to what Eric has to say and to, I guess, really listen with intent is what I'm trying to say, because if you do that, you'll get a lot from this. So I hope you enjoy this podcast. It was an absolute thrill and a pleasure to record. We recorded this late at night in Canberra, early in the morning in the US. And so I'm really grateful to Eric for getting up first thing, having a bit of coffee and coming onto the show. So it's a lot of fun. So anyway, here's Eric. I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I enjoyed recording it. Hi everyone, welcome back to SavvyDentist.com and to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. My guest today is someone whose podcast I've listened to, someone who's got a great YouTube channel, someone who's an interesting person and who is interested in people, and I'm talking about, of course, Eric Hunley. Eric, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to come and hang with us. It's early morning for you, late in the evening for me. We're both drinking coffee, and I'm going to see which one of us is going to be up and about faster soon. My money's on you, my friend. How are you doing?
All right. How are you doing? And normally when I talk to your side of the world, I'm talking to tomorrow. So it's an unusual state for me to be on the same day.
Well, there you go. And that is a funny thing, isn't it? Because I think we're about 14 hours apart.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I talk to a mutual friend of ours all the time, Tyson, and usually I'm cracking a beer and he's out walking the dog.
Yeah, I know. He's an early riser. He does walk a lot. He did that 365-day walking challenge, which you might remember. So Tyson, if you're listening, get back on it. Eric, you've recorded a lot of podcasts. I checked this evening in preparation, 255 episodes out now, plus your YouTube channel. You've done a lot of things in that space. But what I'm really interested to go through is to ask you, what got you into podcasting? What was it that led you into that space?
Podcasting, I would say that, first off, I'm a professional consumer of podcasts.
Me too.
So that's what really ultimately got in. You know, like, first of all, I'm a listener. I got into audiobooks, especially right around 2003. It took me a few tries to get into them, and it took getting a good narrator, a good story, and the right circumstances to understand how to listen to an audiobook. And I bring this up because podcasts are sort of the same way. You have to be trained to know how to listen to them. And by that, I mean out mowing, out running, out driving. Whatever, you can multitask while doing podcasts. The problem is that with a podcast or audiobook, if you go to sit down and listen to it, I'll fall asleep. So I'll give you a professional tip on that really quickly. My wife taught me, play solitaire on the computer.
Oh.
It's just enough to keep your eyes stimulated while you listen to the book so you can continue listening, because you're only you only have an hour to go and you want to finish this really great book or this yep. really cool podcast. So you can do this mindless activity that doesn't require you to lose focus or concentration. You're just barely holding it in there and you can really enjoy the experience while you're sitting too. So that's your tip to be a mini hour a day listener. Now for getting in and interviewing, I always kind of wanted to do it. And I love Apple products. Mm-hmm. I'm sort of an addict of them. And I thought about doing a podcast on Apple stuff because I listened to John Gruber's Daring Fireball, Leo Laporte's Tech TV, or, you know, all of that. And, or I'm sorry, Twit, This Week in Tech, and then MacBreak Weekly.
Yep.
I realized, well, what am I going to do with that? They're already there. I enjoy listening to them. How am I going to do anything with it?
Yeah, sure.
So I sort of put it on the back burner. Then I got into a running jack. And during the running, I was like, well, I could do a running podcast. There's definitely a market for that. There's room. I could probably fit something in, but I'm not sure what to do. And the more I thought about it, I just would buy equipment. So I was like, okay, I'll buy a microphone, a cheap one, buy a mixing board, a cheap one. And every time I think I'm going to start up, I found that, oh, I just don't have the equipment for that, or I just don't have the reason for that. And the reason why I'm giving you this is a spread of over 10 years.
Oh, wow. That long.
Of, you know, actually getting into it.
Yeah.
So, and ultimately, I just kind of came to the realization that while I loved running and I loved listening to podcasts and audiobooks while running, especially because that's training up to marathons, and they're good when you're out for 3+ hours.
Mm-hmm.
And there's only so much I'm going to talk about. You know, which training method are you using? How are you eating? And what kind of runs are there? Well, there's only so many runs, so many ways that you could do it. And sure, it's infinite how you mix it up. But the truth is, it's still kind of boring after a while.
Yeah.
And I realized later, because one of the things I listened to was audiobooks and enjoyed people like Malcolm Gladwell, Jonathan Haidt, and just authors who really make you think. And there was a podcaster, for whatever reason, I'll occasionally listen to Joe Rogan. And Joe Rogan had Sam Harris on. Sam Harris was bitching about another podcaster who was on Joe Rogan, Hunter Motz.
Oh, really?
And Hunter kind of went after Sam Harris. He was in a jag then. I don't know why he did, but I don't know why I'm capricious or I'm weird, but I thought, okay, who's this Hunter Motz guy? So I went listening to it and realized he was Brian Callen's partner.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a podcast called Mixed Mental Arts. It was formerly the Brian Callen Show. It went through a lot of, you know, variations, but all they did was interview these amazing authors that I loved.
Wow.
And I thought, I want to do that.
Yeah.
I want to be able to talk to this particular author or that particular author or just that cool person. And I'm not as smart as these other people in the Facebook group, because there was a whole Facebook group. And I don't know if you've been around either libertarians or hardcore intellectuals, but they can be kind of annoying.
Yeah, kind of a lot. And also, to be honest with you, sometimes a little bit intimidating, because some of the conversation goes over my head, to be honest with you, Eric. And I'm thinking, I've never normally struggled to hold a conversation, but sometimes I feel a bit out of my depth.
Oh, absolutely. Some of them are brilliant. Some are just pedantic. It is a challenge, but I thought, well, I want to be able to just ask questions without proving that I'm smarter than the guest.
Yes. Yes.
And that's one of the issues I find that happen. Like, Hunter's a brilliant guy. He went to Harvard. He actually went to school with Prince William and Harry.
Oh, wow.
The same high school. I guess one time he had to discipline Harry. And he said that was uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But anyway, he's brilliant. His mentor at the school was the guy who did something with the DNA, like co-founded or whatever. And I'm like, okay, that's all awesome. And he could go up and get heavy with the guests and go deep. That's great while I'm learning. But I just want to ask more, not approachable, accessible. Yep. I guess accessible questions. Yep. Like, well, why did you do that exactly? Or what did you mean by blah, blah, blah?
Mm.
in basic English. And I don't mind being dumb. I will happily say when they're going on explanation, what does that mean exactly? Or I don't know. Sorry, I don't understand. And that enabled me to really have a rich, fulfilling conversation. I'm treating it like I almost named it Idea Pub, because my whole idea was that we're sitting back in a pub, both of us having a beer, and hopefully the audience is somebody else sitting at the table. And we're just, you know, I'm like, you do what? How does that work?
Yeah. Yeah. Nice. So you've spoken to some really interesting people. You've spoken to a lot of the people from your clandestine services, intelligence communities. You've spoken to some hardcore people, Chris Voss, for instance, Dave Fries, as we mentioned off air. Dave came and spoke at our event recently. Super smart guy and lovely dude as well. I want to ask you, in all the different things and the different people you've interviewed, what is it that fascinates you most about people?
I don't know exactly, because every person is so individual. I really try to find the individual themselves. I guess what fascinates me most is people themselves. There's always so much more to a person than they realize or I realize. And it makes sense, because if, for example, we're a spy and we go undercover, do clandestine operations every day, or even social engineer, and our job is to break into buildings. I understand that is exciting to a lot of people, and they understand it's exciting to a lot of people, but for them, it's a day job. And sometimes there's elements of our lives where we think blah, 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 blah. And then you're like, wait, what?
Yeah.
You did what? Because it's trivial if that's all we do all the time. But it's very, very fascinating to me. And sometimes those little details or the whys of the world, I mean, I guess it's sort of a Simon Sinek why, but I'm very interested in why somebody is doing something or why something works. I used to teach programming and I would focus on the why. If you know the why, you'll always get the what.
Well, I think that's true in life, really.
Yeah, it's a weird way to look, but if you always figure out why something is going on, you know what the conclusion is going to be.
So in the interviews that you've done, I understand that you find people fascinating in general, and every person's unique and they all have their own layers of complexity and layer upon layer upon layer. One of the things I've found as an interviewer is I learn probably more than anyone. I always feel like the luckiest person in the room, right? And so I want to ask you, have you learned anything particularly about yourself that you didn't know beforehand?
That's an interesting question. One, I'm a much better communicator than I ever thought. I don't know that I've learned a ton, because I'm a curious person.
Did your communication skills improve by podcasting? Learning to listen better and, asking those questions?
Yes. My communication and my guesting, like, that's an interesting paradigm too. Right now I'm doing the guest role. There's a guest role. There's an interview role, and both are a skill, and it's very interesting. That has improved. My observational skills have improved. My research skills have improved. Influence skills have improved. Just understanding how to look for a story or know when things are going right or they're going wrong, or I don't know. You start to develop a feel by just doing the reps.
I think you're absolutely right. And one of the things, this is really practical and important for dentists. So ladies and gents, if you're listening in here, there's some wonderful skills that you do develop, I believe, by paying attention. And as Eric said, doing those reps, doing the research, digging a little deeper, going further. Are there any particular practices that you've had that have made that easier for you, Eric? Because, again, I'm just thinking about the guests listening, I beg your pardon, the audience listening to this show, and thinking that's a really fascinating thing. What sort of reps do we do? How do we hone that skill? How could we take that concept and make it our own, even if we're not a podcaster?
I would say that over-preparation is both a blessing and a curse.
Every single person listening to this is going to be a perfectionist, just so you know. Dentists are perfectionistic on a scale unknown to most. So over-preparation or under-preparation is very rarely a risk for a dentist.
Okay. Well, no, that's good to hear. But In the case, and I will frame it for an interview because I'm known, I'll spend 10 plus hours researching every guest.
Wow.
And that's part of why I've gotten extremely picky about who I have on, because if I'm going to invest this amount of time, I have a full-time job, it better be interesting.
Mm.
But when I do all of this, I have to be able to go into it as if it's fresh. And now it's a challenge because a guest is telling me something that I've heard 50 times. I'm bored of it.
Mm.
I already know it, but my audience doesn't know it. So thus this over preparation can lead into the, what we call the curse of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And this may apply over in the sense that if you know something so well, you can take shortcuts or you may skip steps or you may just be so confident in what you're saying. Yeah. Next. That now all of a sudden I left the important points out of the interview. And yes, okay, they mentioned that their parents were robbed of the bank robber, or James Fallon, he discovered he was a psychopath by looking at his own brain scan. Well, that's only story he's told over and over and over. So I went all over the place, but I still got to tell that story. You know, it's kind of like a band. People get really angry when they don't play their best song.
Absolutely.
And I do think that you've got to be really careful with that in the interviewing, but in anything in life, it's like, while that step is tedious, that's still important.
I think that's really interesting, actually, Eric. And again, I just want to draw this parallel because as dentists who listen to this, we interview people in our clinical work all day.
Mm-hmm.
People will come to see us. We'll be taking a history and we'll be asking them about their relevant dental, social, medical history. And again, we might be explaining things to them. And again, we've been through that explanation a million times. And as you quite rightly point out, there's a tendency or at least a risk of just skipping through the important pieces. So I think one of the things I'm hearing you say is do the preparation and be thorough every single time, irrespective of you know, whether it's your millionth time you've done it or whether it's the first time you've done it. And I certainly know in my own case, Eric, when I've skipped the preparation or been a little bit, I don't know if this translates, we have an expression here, a bit slapdash with things. It's a bit, you know, just kind of going through the motions.
I can picture it. It's a great term.
Yeah.
Love Aussie terms.
Yeah. So if you're a bit slapdash about it, you get found out pretty quickly or something doesn't quite go to plan. So I think there's some really interesting things there. I wanted to ask you, because you are heavily involved in that behavioral science space. And and again, I know you've interviewed lots of people in various roles that have been able to shed some light on that as well. What are the things that you think have really captured your imagination through those conversations or things you've observed of your own as well?
Well, I'm going to tag on what we were just talking about because it actually leads into this too. When you're interviewing somebody, like you mentioned a patient, there are maybe tendencies to already know the answer to your own question or to fill in the blank behind yourself. Like, I can imagine, like, you interview somebody, you're like, okay, do you drink every day? And they say, yeah, I have two. You write six. And you just, and some of that is probably true, but there's a lot in the persuasion racket and things like that to where you ask them a question, they give you an answer, and you might say, and? And what else?
Mm.
Oh, and what else? And use silence.
Mm.
And this goes into interrogation, negotiation, all kinds of stuff. And it's really hard to break it all down because then you can have statement analysis that's put into this mix of what they say, how they're using pronouns, what order they put things in is incredibly important. If you say what's wrong today and they give you an order, that order means something.
Mm.
Whatever they say first is relevant. Now, putting it more in the area I understand, if you say, who are your kids? And they say Sally, Pete, and Matt, but the birth order is actually Matt, Sally, and Pete. Well, then that means Sally's in trouble lately or something's up with Sally.
Mm. Mm.
Because Sally's top of mind.
Yeah.
So that's an element that I've learned. So, just silence, how to really listen. And we talked about Chris Voss earlier. Sometimes mirroring can be incredibly helpful for that too. I went to the store yesterday.
Mirroring, I think, in dentistry is incredibly important. Most people come into the dental practice quite afraid, or a lot will come in afraid. Not most, but it's a decent proportion. And they'll have their guard up. And so, of course, mirroring is a great way to build rapport, as you'd be aware. What other tools or tactics are you aware of that you could use to build rapport quickly and easily?
Well, I'll use freeze on that one. The fear element is, I know you're afraid now, but what if you weren't afraid when you came in? What would that look like?
Do you know, you sounded exactly like Dave Freeze when you said that, the voice and all, not just the words, the voice. I mean, I feel like I'm just listening to Dave in this podcast going, oh my God, is he here with us? Ladies and gents, for those people that are at our practice mastery event just recently who saw Dave Freeze, you'll know exactly what Eric did just there. It was fantastic. So rapport and being in sync with another person, again, really aids communication. Are there any other tools or things to consider if you're looking to be more effective in your communication? We've spoken about rapport. We've used mirroring as an example of that. We've used Dave's language as well. What other things do you think people should be aware of if they're trying to enhance their communication skills?
Rapport is to me everything.
Yeah.
If you can't pay attention to the little things, you know, if you observe something, throw it out there. Most of my best interviews, like I had Chris Voss on, that's a challenge in of itself because he's been in a lot of shows and big shows. And I know that I stood out to him because I threw him on his heels to start. I'm always looking for an edge or an in or something to knock people off their guard. And I don't mean it in a bad way. I mean it in the whole, what? Where then now they're paying attention because everybody comes on, they have talking points. Blah, 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 boom. Blah, 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 boom. With Voss, I just said, you're from Iowa, right? I think it is Iowa. He's like, yeah. And I'm like, well, if you're from Iowa, are you like the Army where everybody ultimately trains somewhere in the South? And as they go up through the U.S. Army, they sound like a Southerner. Is that why you sound like a New Yorker? And he just started, he's like, well, you know, I got to talk to the people. And it was some variant of that, but that is extremely early. So I'm just coming up with this weird thing from left field. What relevance does it have to his book?
Yeah.
Nothing. None. What relevance does it have to anything? But it's a little personality quirk. If you watch Voss, he's got the late night DJ voice. He's this cool cat, you know, I'm Voss. How you doing? And you just, if you ever interview him, it's actually sad listening to his audiobook because he has a cool vibe and sound, but that's what I'm looking for. So observe people. If they have a really outlandish pen or a weird thing or just something, ask. Why would they put something bright and bold and crazy on themselves? It's meaningful. It's important to them. And now all of a sudden you learn something about the person. It's much more deep and much closer to their soul, be it their voice, the way they talk, if they have an accent, if there's a term they use, if they're wearing that crazy pin and it turns out their granddaughter gave it to them. And, you know, they love their granddaughter and that was an important, meaningful day. And it doesn't take that long.
Ladies and gents, there's some absolutely fantastic communication skills that Eric has just shared with you. And if you just go back and rewind and listen to the last couple of minutes of that, because I guarantee you, if you do and you practice that, then you're going to be much better ahead with your communication skills. Now, in the interest of throwing a few little curveballs here, there, and everywhere, I want to go back to the marathon running because, you know, it takes a special kind of sadist to be a marathon runner. And I'm wondering, what on God's earth prompted you to run 42 kilometers? Or I'm not sure what that is in miles, 26 miles or something like that?
26.2.
Yeah, 26.2. So
that's the Queens.
Exactly. The 0.2 actually matters a great deal because I've only run a half marathon, but I think that takes a little bit of sadism to be a marathon runner. So I'm curious to ask, what drove you to that? Why did you get into marathons?
Well, sadly, I've fallen out of marathon shape and I have to get back into it. but I was 283 pounds and just started walking.
Yeah.
Now, I was in the U.S. Army way back in the 90s. Peacetime, I don't need, you know,
yeah,
not really a big deal, but we did PT. We ran 2 miles for a test,
yep,
things like that. So I would just go out and walk. I had a treadmill inside the house. I burned it up quite literally and had to take it outside. And yeah, I had ordered an elliptical machine and I had to wait for like 3 weeks. And I wasn't going to wait because I was on a regimen. I'm going to walk every day. I'm at 10,000 steps.
Yep.
So I went outside and I got it. That's an interesting story because I don't know if you've heard of the band Deep Purple.
Yeah.
All right. Well, John Lord died in 2012, summertime range, somewhere in there.
Mm-hmm.
And it reminded me about the band, who I never could stand Smoke on a Water. It just kind of was redundant and annoying to me.
Oh, wow. See, that's my favorite song.
Is it really? Well, sorry to hear that. I discovered the early catalog, though, with Child in Time, mm-hmm, and stuff like that. It was mind-blowing. I had never realized how good and how intense these long tracks were. And I got so hyped up listening to it, I ran a couple blocks, yeah, you know, just to get off the energy.
Yep.
And then I walked, and then I ran a couple blocks again. You know, normally I'd be listening to a podcast or audiobook, but for whatever reason, you know, his dying just spurred me. I really want to kind of listen to this, and I just put it on the loop almost.
Yeah.
So then I was like, okay, well, you know, a couple blocks here, a couple blocks there, you know, resting in between. I wonder if I could do a mile. I mean, it's a mile. I used to run, you know, just a few miles all the time. Let me try doing a mile. It's been years, but I'll do that. So then I ran a mile. And of course, you always want to pad, because how do you know it's really a mile? Or in your case, a K? Well, you got to make sure that you have a little bit of wiggle room, because, you know, if you can't track it, it's not real.
Yeah, totally.
So,
yeah.
So yeah, I always pad a little bit. So then I just go a little bit further and a little bit further. And that's like 1.5. Well, you know, in the Army, we had a PT test. That's 2 miles.
Yep.
If I could do one or a little more, well, why not two? Let me go for two. So boom, I did 2 miles. Then I was like, okay, 5K.
Mm-hmm.
Next thing up is 5K, which is 3.1 miles.
Yes.
We're doing the math back and forth. Let me go and do that. And I did that. Now, meanwhile, I dropped a bunch of weight. And I was like 42.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to visit my nephew. And he was in the cross-country team in high school and everything else. And we went out running. And to my great satisfaction, I could outrun him and outpace him at the time. Well, he was way out of shape. Trust me, when he's in shape.
Yeah. But
anyway, long story. He was like, you're pretty fast for somebody old.
Did you slap him?
No. I mean, that's true.
Yeah.
He's like, you know, they have age groups in races and, you know, 40 plus or whatever, but you might do really well. And I was like, really? It sparked my imagination. If I could get it a little, you know, award for it. So I went and I ran a 5K and I came in. Unfortunately, the age group wasn't 40 to 45. It was 40 to 50. So mm-hmm, a couple of 45 to 50, another 45 to 50 year old had a snake in front of me, but I got fourth place in that age group.
Nice.
I was like, okay. And then I think I ran a couple weeks later and I got like second or third place in the age group. Then I got like third place overall in a 5K. So, you know, I was just piling them on and I'm like, oh, wow. You know, this is really fun. This is cool. Even though they hurt.
Yeah.
Because it's like, you know, kind of just all out. So then that just expanded. You know, it's like, okay, let me run to this. I wonder, you know, ultimately if I could do a half marathon. And so I ran a couple half marathons in training, you know, just ran the 13.1, whatever, no biggie. And did the half marathon. Now I'm not placing or anything like that in that because of distance, but it was like, oh, this is cool. And there was a half marathon called the Crawling Crab that happens to, in the route, go in front of my house even.
Oh, wow. Like,
that'd be cool, you know, to go run and get around the house. So I did that, did other half marathons, which of course then leads to, hey, can you do a marathon? And ultimately, can you do a 50K? And that's just kind of how it went, because then it was like on marathon, not only am I doing a marathon, I wonder if I could qualify for Boston.
Oh, wow.
Which I didn't.
Okay.
But still did well. I'm what you call a front of a mid-pack runner.
Okay. That's great.
You know, or, oh, yeah. I mean, it's fine. but you always want more.
So the funny thing is, when I was younger, I've got a military background as well, and I remember doing those PT tests as well, and, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth, and I've gotten back into running, although COVID has derailed that a little at the moment, but notwithstanding that, the thing that you've spoken about, I really resonate with, and that is, you know, incremental, you know, if I do this, maybe I can do that, then I can perhaps do the next thing and the next and the next, and all of a sudden you find yourself running these distances. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to ask you, as you went through that process, do you find that running for you is meditative in any way? Do you find you're getting yourself into a little happy place?
Yes and no. The funny thing about running is the runner's high maybe fits because it's so much of a lie. Very few runs just feel good.
Yeah.
When they do, it's amazing. It's like, I just did the everything clicked. I was just running. And the next day, you're just plodding. You're just, blah, blah, blah. And I realized that's why it's addictive.
Yeah.
Because if it always felt that where everything just clicked, it would be boring.
Yeah.
But it's always, you have this one run and everything's just amazing. It's smooth. You feel like, you know, like all those memes where they show, you know, the graceful thing running and or and then it, the plodding thing behind is what you are. Well, you feel like just this total freedom. You're in sync with yourself, et cetera. And that may be, you know, somewhat meditative. I like it, too, because I'm going slow enough. Like anytime I travel, if I, you know, could run, I would always discover an area. Mm. So if you, let's say, go to D.C., I ran around all the national parks, and it's really nice to be on the ground and experience. You're going slow enough that you're getting a lot of details you'll never see when you're driving around.
Yes.
So I love that. But the addictive aspect is that the next day it just sucks. And so what are you doing? You're always chasing that one stupid high that you got.
It's so elusive, isn't it? And I've got a friend of mine who's a golfer, and he says it's exactly the same thing for golf in the sense that you hit that one good shot, and you play another 20 rounds of golf to try and hit another one good shot. And
yeah, and you're thinking, what did I eat that day? How did
what did I do? Yeah, what was the air like? What was the wind doing? What club did I use?
Oh yeah,
all of those sorts of things.
Stuff up.
Yeah, totally. And then it becomes a complete nonsense. So I want to ask you though, in the work that you've done, whether it's podcasting or otherwise, have you ever experienced something similar to a runner's high?
In podcasting, especially. There will be times where you just get so deep and everybody's so vulnerable that you just feel like something happened, that you've got a relationship that's taken to a whole new level. Jim Clemente, I'm very happy with that interview, but we went really deep and he talked about getting leukemia and dying on the table. It was this, I don't know how to explain, but you're in a conversation, just all of a sudden it takes a turn. And I've always loved that whole late night thing where everybody's exhausted, about to go to bed, and then all of a sudden things just get real. And I feel like that in them. A recent one, I had Janine Driver on, and she was really vulnerable. And we talked about the fact, you know, she's one of the top profilers in the world. She, you know, teaches people body language literally on the defense level. She teaches departments. Her partner scammed her of like $50,000 in business.
Wow.
Which is very hard when you're the top body language reader in the world, known as the lie detector.
Yeah.
Celebrity lie detector or the lion tamer. And you get burned because we all are vulnerable. And that really, I kind of live for those moments because it's almost cathartic, if you will. You know, we're going somewhere. We're really discovering. And I feel like I'm actually sharing this person that you may not really know. And I've managed to surface this great information.
So it's interesting that, Eric, because those moments can't be manufactured, in my experience. I think you just have to have that rapport that we spoke about in spades. And the guest has got to be willing to go there, and you as the interviewer have to be skillful enough to get there as well. And there's a lot of stars that need to align for that moment. And
oh, yeah.
And it's magic when it happens.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about vulnerability for a moment and mm-hmm. where you see the role of vulnerability in life. I mean, you'd be familiar with Brené Brown and her work in vulnerability. And
you know, I haven't read any of that. I know I know she's out there in a big name, but I haven't crossed that particular one.
Really? Okay. So if you like Malcolm Gladwell books, can I put on your Christmas reading list Brené Brown's work?
I'll probably try to get her on the show.
Yeah.
That's kind of been my thing too. It's like, okay, just in time learning. Let me read their book immediately before they come on.
Yeah, well, if you get her on the show before I get her on mine, I'll have to buy you a beer because I've reached out to her about a dozen times. So Brené, if you're listening to this show, please come back to me on the email. That would be really handy. But I think, you know, she talks a lot about vulnerability and essentially that it's a strength. And the leader who is vulnerable is able to connect more deeply. And of course, connection is what gives meaning and purpose to our lives, is her hypothesis. So I wanted to ask you, you know, in your particular experience, where have those vulnerabilities been for you? What is it that makes you tick? How do you relate to people when they're being vulnerable? What's that mean for you?
When somebody is being vulnerable with me, and I think everyone should feel this, I feel honored.
Mm.
And I feel that this is a sacred moment. And it is my job to be there and also to protect them at the same time, if that makes sense. If I make them feel comfortable enough to go into the state, then we're on a journey together.
Mm.
And I don't know how to explain, because a lot of it is very gut level feelings. I mean, I physically will feel it.
Mm.
And it's almost a mix of discomfort and joy at the same time, because it's a very perilous, very thin string, and that's the, you know, it's a one step either direction, and we can really do some damage, or cause anger, or just lose it. It's very hard to navigate. I don't know how to explain that any further. It's almost more of what you feel than what you think.
Yeah, and I think the other thing, it takes some courage from the interviewer as well. And again, ladies and gents, if you're listening to this, I think this happens in dentistry all the time, is sometimes your guest or your patient, whatever forum you happen to be in, will put something out there.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, I know when I've been interviewing people, Eric, I've been a bit afraid to pick that thing up that they've put out there. Do you know what I mean? Like they've said something. And there's something that you kind of go, wow, I could really pick that up and talk about that. There's a meaty piece. And it takes courage sometimes to pick that up because you know you're going to go down a path that may be welcome, may not be welcome. But assuming they've put that out there, you know, it's probably okay to pick it up. So I wanted to just talk about that for a moment, about when people give you something to run with in a conversation and having the courage to pick that up.
Sometimes talk around it.
Mm.
You know, like if you're uncertain, because sometimes people throw things out there. You're right. People signpost because they're either subconsciously or unconsciously or consciously telling you, here's something. If it seems, and a lot of it, again, it's gut. Mm. You're navigating it.
Totally.
If you don't know if you should go directly at that, kind of go askance.
Mm.
I kind of ask a question near it. Or something that rhymes, if you will. You know, there's an old saying, history never repeats itself, but it rhymes.
Sure does, yeah.
Ask them a question, and it's really hard to say without, perfect examples. But if they throw out a question about, or a statement about, I don't know, let's say their sister drowning.
Mm.
And you know that that's probably had an effect on people.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know if, how long ago was that? What da-da-da-da? Try to come up with a way maybe to give them an opportunity to inject it.
Mm.
Like, has there ever been anyone or any circumstance that's had such a profound meaning on your life where today you're one person, but tomorrow or the next day you're somebody completely different?
Mm.
And if that doesn't kick that or something like it, then they're not wanting to share. You know, that they might go surfacey and go, well, you know, in business, often people will, you know, report to work and then there's a shakeup in leadership. And you're like, okay, well, maybe they don't want to go there. And you can ask maybe a couple other questions to give them that chance. Like, you threw something out there. Let's see if you're going to finish that.
Mm. It's really interesting, isn't it? Because you're quite right. Sometimes I've had guests signposted in a really big way and I have picked it up. And then all of a sudden there's a almost like a backpedaling of, oh, I don't want to go there. And we move on to different territory. And other times when you do pick that up and they are happy to go there, that's, I find, when you get that moment of connection, that vulnerability space that we spoke about. So, ladies and gents, I would encourage you with your patience if you're going through this, because dentistry is a place where, you know, you, without sounding weird, you literally put your hands in someone else's body, in the mouth. So there's vulnerability there. And I think there's lots of patients who have had some adverse experiences, and I'd encourage you to take heed of what Eric has shared there, because I think if you can get to that vulnerability space, if patients are willing to get there, you will create a relationship. You'll go beyond rapport to relationship, and that patient will be yours forever because you get there.
I would say even more importantly, and I don't know if it's easy to do, but after whatever procedure is even more important, because if they leave on an upswing, their last memory of you will not be the pain of the procedure, but hopefully the connection that you have made after the fact.
Yeah. And I want to ask you, Eric, have you always been good with communication, or is it something, a skill that you've learned? And I guess one of the things I want to ask you about is, where have you stuffed it up?
I think that I've always been good at reading people. At sensing it. And a lot of that was, I was a sick kid, wasn't able to play with other kids. So I spent a lot of time, you know, from 5 years old through eight, or, you know, I don't even remember the ages. I don't remember most of my childhood at all, but I would wear a jacket in the middle of summer in Tucson.
What was that about?
You know, just that.
So you were really very sick.
Yeah. I had, you know, this bad allergies that turned into asthma, but I grew up on a ranch and I'm allergic to hay, and we had hay. And so it was just exacerbating. But yeah, I had like adrenaline shots to the chest and things like that when I would go into full blown problems. It actually helped me later with running, because I understand not being able to breathe and drowning in air. It's very painful. So when I get in a very painful point running, I had experienced extreme pain as a child in breathing, so I kind of can mitigate it more, if that makes any sense. But to keep on track, I think that I would always be watching the other kids interact or play with each other when I wasn't being bullied myself. And I learned to read. So I learned to watch them, how they interact with each other, watch, am I in danger right now because of a particular kid? And I spent all my time with the girls. And girls are, they typically, especially as children, are more emotionally sensitive and in line. And I think I learned some of those tactics, if you will. Now, where did I stuff it up? Oh, God.
Can we come back to the bullying thing for a second? I'm just curious to ask about that.
Sure.
How did that impact on you?
It wasn't fun. And, you know, I guess it was always in the back of my mind being shameful, because I would actually fight. Because my father was, you know, like the toughest person I knew, kind of a redneck, what you call him, badass, blah, 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 Marine, recon, all that stuff. And his father sparred with Joe Louis, the boxer. So it was like every generation is a little weaker. So I was the weakest of the lot in that. But he would be ashamed if I didn't. So I kind of felt a little like I had to prove to him. And proved to them, I didn't really want to fight, but I'd fight anyway. And so I wouldn't have to face his wrath. So I don't know. There's you know, obviously a lot of psychological things in all of that. But bullying, oddly enough, didn't turn me into a bully. It made me more of a protector, a very, very conscious of people around me. And if I see somebody getting burned, I tend to react even more strongly than if I'm getting burned, if I care about them or know them. And I have a good memory in terms of slights like that. It's funny. I don't remember my own life, but I'll remember a slight that somebody did to somebody else.
Yeah. Okay. So I think, look, there's a lot we can explore there at some point, but I'm speaking of signposting, it's interesting because I find, you know, I've spoken to lots of people in my podcast who have been bullied at various points, and it's quite an interesting thing that a lot of people have said to me. I've had a few people that said they became bullies as a protective mechanism. So rather than being on the end of it, they became the aggressor. Other people like yourself became protectors, and other people became, they disappeared. You know, they kind of tried to make themselves invisible in a sense.
Sure. I did that as well, depending on the
circumstance. You know, the time. Yeah. And it's a really interesting
and
thing.
Age.
Yeah. And oftentimes those patterns have, for some other people, have carried through their life and have shown up in their adult life. And I'm curious to ask you, has that shown up in your adult life?
Not a lot. You see, that's the weird part. I was bullied. I was tiny. I had all that. Then I had a growth spurt.
Mm.
So I went from being really tiny. I'm 6'2". Well, north of 200 pounds. I'm bigger than most people that I come across. And that's advantageous.
Yes.
In terms of, I very, very seldom feel physically threatened in any way. So how can I keep drawing back to that other feeling? I don't have that feeling. I can intimidate people if I want to intimidate people. It's I feel like everything is shaped by how you're raised, the circumstances around you, and how you choose to internalize or not, or is it the locus of control? I'm a big believer in that. So I don't know if I'm answering the question or I'm meandering.
No, meandering is okay. It's interesting because I was a small kid. I didn't have the growth spurt that you had, so I'm still small. And so it's quite easy for me to be talking to someone or in a physical situation where, you know, it's not uncommon for me to be out at night and I'll be constantly scanning my physical surroundings. Mm. I'm a small guy. And so if I get into a fight with a 6'2" guy, the odds are I'm going to get the crap kicked out of me. And so I'm quite alert for danger. And it's quite interesting that for me has been something that means that perhaps I'm in some ways quite risk averse and hyper alert and hyper vigilant. But what's really interesting around that is, this is me interviewing you. I'm not meant to be doing this, but for me, the way I fought bullies was to become very acerbic. It was to become incredibly sharp with my tongue and to eviscerate people verbally. And
would embarrass them.
Totally, and humiliate them and belittle them.
Sure.
More than once, that didn't serve me well, I'll tell you, Eric, because...
No. Because... Especially if they're not bright enough.
Exactly.
Ironically, you need to have that bully who was bullied at one point or somebody who is bright enough to realize that you've actually caused them some damage. Somebody who is not bright enough to understand the subtlety of the sarcasm or the irony that you're pushing on them will just hit you because that's how they cope.
Yeah.
You're doing something to me. I don't completely understand this. So I already feel dumb. So in a weird way, you're bullying them.
Yeah.
I know that sounds crazy, but mentally you are, they're not as capable of handling it. So how do they deal with being attacked? They hit.
Yeah.
So yeah, you probably use the term got your ass kicked a couple of times.
Yeah, I did. I got my ass kicked a couple of times.
But if you took it and everybody else heard you burn them, you still got a weird respect.
Yeah, it was really weird. It was really weird and weirdly satisfying.
Mm-hmm. And they might have left you alone after that.
Yeah, they did because they didn't know what I'd done, but they knew it wasn't good.
Right. So they got their last word and you just keep your distance.
Yeah, and they what they knew is that other people knew what I did as well.
Bingo.
Yeah, because they go, oh, hang on, I don't quite know what happened, but everyone's laughing at me, so it can't be good.
Oh, yeah, and that's even worse, right? I mean, how do you like it if you walk in the room and everybody's like, are they laughing at me? Am I wearing something? I mean, we all feel that. I mean, what is the worst punishment that they had outside of death? Exile.
Yeah.
And that's a form of exile,
yep.
Public, you know, humiliation. This goes all the way into our DNA, all the way to the beginning of time, because we are a pack. And if the pack is laughing at us, we can die.
Yes, absolutely. So it's a really weird thing. And it's funny because I've spoken to lots of people on our podcast who have had a similar similar experience, although sometimes different. But yeah, that's why I'm curious to ask where anyone has ever been bullied, because I sometimes see those patterns continue through life. And even today, you know, I certainly still have a sharp tongue from time to time. I try to keep it locked away most of the time. Hey, Eric.
Do you feel guilt?
Do I feel guilt? Yeah.
Okay. Well, then that makes a difference, because if you know, it's like, did I really need to say that? I kind of have the same thing, but you know, I'm always worried about harming somebody.
I would say, Eric, that I often analyze conversations after the fact and go, "Ooh, I said that. I hope that came out the right way, or I intended it this way, but it didn't seem that it was received the way that I intended it." And then I go into a whole lot of psychoanalysis and tie myself in psychological knots for a good few hours before my wife, who's very pragmatic and very practical, say, "Jesse, enough." And then that's the end of it.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Sounds like an ideal situation.
It is. Eric, we've been uphill and down Dale tonight, and I'm really grateful to you for taking the time out of your day. I know it's the morning there, and I really just want to express my deepest gratitude to you for coming on to our show. Ladies and gents, I would really encourage you to listen to Eric's podcast and, of course, to check out his YouTube channel. You can check out Eric Hunley, the channel on YouTube, and the podcast is Unstructured. And I'd also really encourage you to go through Eric's website, because there's some really cool things in there. There's some great links to, you know, this, that, and the other, and some resources. And do go and have a good poke and prod around, because there's some wonderful things there. Eric, if you were going to leave our audience with a couple of words of wisdom or some thoughts to consider, what would be the things that you'd think would be helpful?
Two words. Be kind.
Wow. That's really interesting that you chose those words. What prompted you to choose those?
I don't think you could ever go wrong by being kind. Mm. It's just, what do I tell my younger self? I need to be kind to him.
Mm.
What do I tell people who are in pain? Well, be kind.
Mm.
Just be kind. If you're always kind and you always think of trying to be kind, it's always going to be either a net positive or a neutral.
Yeah. Yeah. Really interesting that on the way to our interview tonight, I was driving down to the office because I was telling you that my Wi-Fi died at home. So I'm in my office recording this.
Right,
and I was
right.
Listening to a podcast on the way down here. And it was exactly around that, be kind. So maybe that's the universe telling us all that kindness is a commodity or not a commodity. It's an attribute that we could all perhaps do well to master.
Yeah, or even a value.
Eric? On that very thoughtful and, yeah, really interesting note, I'd like to say thank you once again for coming onto our show. It's been a really wonderful, thought-provoking, and interesting conversation. Thank you, mate.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast with Dr. Jesse Green. For more free tools and resources, join the free Facebook group. Visit drjessegreen.com/Facebook. And for more episodes, visit drjessegreen.com/savvydentist.